organized a WIPO interactive session with NGOs on the development agenda on intellectual property. 455 NGOs were invited. 25 were represented, and among them 13 among the about 100 which had supported the declaration for WIPO development agenda. So this is somewhat disappointing, of course, even if I understand that it is less exciting to go to Geneva than to Tunis, of course. But the voice of NGOs needs to be heard also in day-to-day work. For instance, a matter discussed at this World Summit on Information Society, the digital gap between rich industrialized countries and developing countries. The weak and the poor need protection more than the rich and the powerful. It would be discriminating to consider that developing countries are not able of creation and innovation, that they have no knowledge, traditional or other, which deserve protection from being exploited by big countries of, by big companies of rich countries. Well, let us take one example. The music of Jamaica has conquered the world. Jamaican people didn't benefit from it at all because it was international producers or producing companies of big countries which benefited from it. So, because Jamaican didn't know how to protect their own rights and their own creation, and WIPO is helping them to protect it now, and I hope that they will benefit more. Of course, so intellectual property in this way also can guarantee cultural diversity. Well, the UNESCO has just adopted a convention on cultural diversity, but it's more a kind of political commitment. The practical mean to implement the orientations of the UNESCO convention is through intellectual property rights. Internet governance, on internet governance, WIPO is, as you know, is the main arbitration center on international domain, on internet domain names, and has established internet treaties. On all this, the dialogue with NGOs is essential. But in the invitation to this meeting, there were some other questions which I mentioned very rapidly. What is the role of WIPO to determine international intellectual property rights? Well, I'm afraid to disappoint you. Intellectual property rights are determined by each country, and it's a national law, so they are not determined by WIPO. What does WIPO is try to make it work internationally? If countries are able to agree by consensus on common terms of a treaty so that all the national rights are able to work together. And also the role of WIPO is to help countries in establishing their own intellectual property system to protect their own knowledge according to their own characteristics, level of development, and so on. Well, for example, we have one of our main activities is the Patent Cooperation Treaty, which allows with only one application for a patent to have it implemented in 122 countries to make it more user-friendly instead of making 122 démarches and applications to have the same result. So the important is that it would be workable at international level, even with different national rules, and we try to make it more compatible internationally, which is not, as some fear, upward harmonization. Intellectual property protection is not an end in itself. There is no use to go upward in the definition of standards or of norms. What is important is that when there is a globalized world, the rights which are protected in one country could be protected in the others also, if possibly in the same way. Another question was, do digital technologies alter the traditional balance between creators and public? Yes, because there is a very fast technical evolution. When the development of law, and especially international law, is very slow, we have to reach a consensus. So it's always late compared to the technological evolution. There is also a difference of perception. Internet access is very easy, well, for those who can afford to it, is easy. And there is sometimes a confusion between free access and free of charge. When you buy a book, a record, when you go to a concert or a cinema, it seems normal to pay to reward the creator, the author, the interpreters. It is, of course, much less evident on internet. So there is a matter of perception, which changes, of course, the perception of intellectual property rights with the digital technologies. We in WIPO, as one of the thematic work between the two sessions of the World Summit on Information Society, we have organized a forum online, and among the comments which were given in this forum, several stressed that without reward to the authors, the most commercial productions will dominate at the detriment of maintaining rich and open cultural life. And piracy would victimize local cultures as well as economies of developing countries, like counterfeiting kills many more people in least developed countries than in rich countries. Counterfeited baby shampoo killed hundreds of babies in Africa. Counterfeited medicines killed a lot of people. Counterfeited food and drink and so on. And of course, this happens much more in poor developing countries than in rich countries. Well, another question was, I suppose it's the last one, important issues WIPO will address in 2006. Well, first, most important issue will be the development agenda. Well, after the so-called international intergovernmental intersessional meetings, which we organized in the year 2005, we have decided now to have a provisional committee to discuss the development agenda. And it will hold two meetings, but long meetings, two meetings of 1 week each during the year 2006. To debate and continue the debates of the IIM. For the time being, member states do not agree between themselves on the development agenda. There are a small number who want always more and more intellectual property protection. A larger number who like more exceptions and flexibilities. And even more who want to use intellectual property for their development. Well, the question was a development agenda called for by poorer nations. I must say that the leaders in favor of a development agenda are more emerging countries than the least developed countries. The leaders are Brazil and Argentina, which have a growing interest in trade negotiations and do not want to be imposed higher standards of intellectual property protection by a powerful partner in trade negotiations. But this is not WIPO, as I explained, it's more WTO. It's not the same for the least developed countries, which are interested in protecting their traditional knowledge, which is taken by richer and more powerful, and to protect also their fragile capacities of creation and innovation. For WIPO, it would be helpful to have renewed commitments in favor of development, economic, social and cultural development in the framework of the Millennium Development Goals. Member states are discussing that. They have to agree. And in these discussions, NGOs have no doubt a role to play. In 2006, we will also continue and have an intense work on protection of generic resources, traditional knowledge and folklore. I hope there will be progress. A lot of hard work has been done in depth, but of course it is slow work, but it's gaining momentum. And we are working in the direction of all treaties. This also is debated, should it be one treaty or different treaties. But the idea now that there would be binding legal agreements is accepted, which is a big progress. And so we are progressing. We will finish works on a new trademark treaty, maybe broadcasting, certainly not on performers, because the rights are too different on both sides of the Atlantic to find a possible agreement on the protection of performers of audiovisual performances. But the patent treaty and trademarks now are involving more and more developing countries. You know, industrialized countries have more or less stabilized the use of these treaties, but developing countries are increasing, some of them more than 50% a year, their use of these treaties, of these facilities to protect their own innovation. Well, on all these matters, we hope to have the best possible dialogue with NGOs. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Petit. Our next speaker will be Dr. Alex Byrne. We'll just turn over to him.
Thank you, Robin. I have the honor to be the president of IFLA, the International Federation of Library Associations and Institutions. Intellectual property is obviously core business for libraries, but we have broader interests than that. Libraries throughout the world deal daily in intellectual property in all formats. We, as IFLA, have members in more than 150 countries, so we're very aware of the issues throughout the world. In addition, our members serve some 2.5 billion library users around the world, and therefore we're vitally concerned about the interests of users of intellectual property, who are the users of our libraries. We have been involved with WIPO for nearly 10 years now, going backwards and forwards to Geneva for discussions and interventions. And particularly in the last round, where we have worked closely with another organisation called IFOL, Electronic Information for Libraries, we've attended the three intersessional intergovernmental meetings which took place at WIPO in Geneva during this year, 2005. IFLA welcomed the broad agreement of the need for a development agenda, but we shared the frustration of many developing countries in the situation where after 9 days of discussion there was no agreement on either substance or procedure. We hope that the new committee, known as the Provisional Committee, mandated by the WIPO General Assemblies in October 2005, will complete discussions on the outstanding proposals relating to the development agenda for WIPO, and that the committee will be able to report to the General Assemblies in September 2006. IFLA's intervention in this process has been extensive and is documented on the respective websites of IFLA and IFOL. One suggestion of major interest for the library community is for the elaboration by WIPO of an international treaty on access to knowledge and technology. IFLA strongly supports the achievement of a true balance between the rights of owners and the users of intellectual property. Given IFLA's core principle concerning freedom of access to information, and in particular the benefits that a treaty on access to knowledge might bring to libraries and their users, IFLA has supported the recommendations of the 14 Friends of Development Group of member states. In particular, IFLA supported the call to review the WIPO mandate and governance, the promotion of pro-development norm setting, which recognises the different levels of technological, economic and social development in different countries, and also recognises the rights of different stakeholder groups and of the citizens as users of intellectual property. We also support the development of supportive intellectual property and trade policies by industrialised countries. We believe that these changes would bring about a much needed revolution within WIPO, a sea change in its concepts and how it operates. IFLA drew the attention of WIPO member states to the following issues of concern to libraries worldwide. Firstly, the growing imbalance of intellectual property laws in favour of rights holders and to the detriment of users, resulting in constant erosion of exceptions and limitations. And we would add that the rights holders who profit most are seldom the actual creators. Secondly, the monopolisation of information via restrictive intellectual property rules in both print and digital environments. Thirdly, the inhibitive effect of copyright laws on the development of new technology, where the technology in question has substantial non-infringing uses. Fourthly, the constant pressure towards increasing the term of copyright protection, ever upwards in the name of harmonisation. This has resulted in the shrinking of the public domain and a subsequent negative impact on education, research, and creativity. Copyright is supposed to foster creativity, but overprotection actually stifles it. This applies in both developed and developing countries, but the latter rely more on works in the public domain as they have fewer resources with which to buy access to protected works. Fifth, it should be recognised that all creators of intellectual property are themselves users of copyright works and will have made use of the exceptions and limitations to copyright for the purposes of education, research, or private study. Several hundred years ago, Isaac Newton put it well in saying, "If I have seen far, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants." All creators benefit from using intellectual property. The copyright exceptions and limitations are therefore crucial to assist developing countries and least developed countries to catch up with developed countries. In addition, we are particularly concerned about the protection of Indigenous knowledge, which is essential to the well-being and advancement of Indigenous peoples. Our sixth point is that there is also the problem of unfair contractual licences, whose terms are often very difficult for licensees, usually the weaker parties, to negotiate. Furthermore, national laws should protect the statutory exceptions and limitations to copyright from being overridden by contractual terms. Seventh, technological protection measures which override fair use applications and create serious barriers to accessing information and the promotion of research and innovation. Eight, the chasm between the digitally advanced and the digitally deprived is widening. Current copyright rules foster the dependence of developing countries on developed countries and enable developed countries to profit from developing countries. 10. free trade agreements where some developed countries are imposing unnecessarily stricter copyright laws on their free trade partners in excess of the requirements of the Berne Convention and the TRIPS Agreement. WIPO and the World Trade Organization need to work together for a new approach to intellectual property. Above all, IFLA supports the call for an access to knowledge treaty, which we think is necessary to establish a proper international framework, setting the norms by which copyright should be managed and in a manner which ensures that user rights are established and enshrined with respect to the digital age. Such a treaty would counter the trend towards the monopolisation and privatisation of information by ensuring that information remains publicly available to nurture education and innovation. At the World Library Congress 2005 in Oslo, more than 300 librarians from all over the world discussed real-life, everyday problems encountered by librarians in the provision of library services. Increasingly, copyright law is a hindrance, not a help, to libraries and their users. Issues included different rights for different formats, increasing limitations on the use of audiovisual formats, including import rights, especially important for small multilingual countries. Digitalization is hampered because of the lack of an exception for long-term preservation. These are not just issues for developing countries, but also for developed countries, since knowledge is a universal tool and equal access underpins an inclusive, democratic society. As a stakeholder in the process, IFLA welcomes the opportunity for a constructive discussion on the mission and direction of WIPO, both with member states and the Secretariat in Geneva. But we assert that any future models must be firmly based on the right to know, well expressed in Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Byrne. Our next speaker will be Mr. Greff from Free Software Foundation Europe.
Thank you. As you know, or just learned, I'm president of the Free Software Foundation Europe, and our involvement in WIPO, our involvement in WIPO started with a course in the International Training Center of the International Labour Organization in Turin, where I spoke on free software and software patents, and a colleague
Mr.
Petit. I'm very sorry. It's too hot in here. Mr. Roberto Castello at the time spoke with me and suggested that we should actually become accredited to WIPO as observer NGO. Now, those of you who know us know that this might have seemed like a very strange proposition to make to the Free Software Foundation. And indeed, at first it seemed that way, but then we realized that it really made a lot of sense. We had been becoming involved in the political issues over the years, you know, also during the World Summit on the Information Society, where I had the responsibility to co-coordinate the Patents, Copyrights and Trademarks Working Group with Francis Muguet. And we've been working on these issues in this context before, so going to WIPO, where most of these issues are actually being handled on a day-to-day basis, seemed to make a lot of sense. And indeed, by the way that we named the working group, Patents, Copyrights and Trademarks, and not Intellectual Property Working Group, it already shows where our issues really begin. Because, you see, we consider the term intellectual property to be rather problematic. It tries to be a, you know, catch-all term for very different areas of law, because copyright and patents and trademarks and the other sets of laws that are summarized under that padding are actually very different. We've struggled here at the WSIS with finding alternatives, denominations, descriptions, how should we talk about this? And that was not always an easy struggle. It seemed that ultimately what these areas of law are limited monopolies granted by society. And if you look at the justification, which was very correctly pointed out, for these monopolies for the benefit of society, that is how these monopolies originally arose. That is how copyright came to be, how patents came to be, and that is what we believe should be the basis of all these laws today and in the future. We also feel that some of the terms are highly ideologically charged in this area right now. People have been joking about a church of IPR due to terms like piracy and other, interesting terms, because piracy, to me, when I was a kid, meant robbing a ship on the high seas, killing the crew, taking the bounty. That this should be the moral equivalent of somebody who copies a CD for a friend because he thinks that music is good, that software is good, and he wants his friend to have the same music, the same software, and call that person a pirate. So the moral equivalent of someone who robs ships and kills people. We struggle with that concept, I have to say it. What we think, what we need instead, is a clear and diversified dialogue. We think we have to talk about these issues in a more complex setting. We live in a complex world. Why are the copyright rules for, computer software the same than for literature, than for other areas? I mean, why are these things identical? I don't think they are, and I think, indeed, it makes sense for us to consider them separately. The WIPO policies and direction have been largely determined by industry interests who were represented at WIPO quite early. Many of the, higher standards, more monopolization kind of approaches actually come very directly from industry, rights-holding industry, not the people who actually write, and not the people who read, certainly, but rather the people who are sitting as intermediaries, earning their money from, keeping the things that are written from the people who could read it, and regulating that flow. There was a balance to this system at some point, probably. I mean, even before digital technology came on, we saw that the balance didn't quite work as well as it should, but there was a more inherent balance before digital technology. But the ability to transfer knowledge without loss across the planet in real time has definitely changed the playing field. It has, for the first time, separated the medium, which was, the book, the paper, from what is printed, from the story, from what you have in that book. This now exists in a kind of virtual space, and that is unique. The laws for copyright were essentially industrial monopolies in the beginning for reproduction of paper books, because there was no way to conceive that you could separate the story from the paper. Today that's normal, everybody does it. So that balance, however well it may have functioned before, has been unsettled. It's a new struggle now to find a balance, hopefully find a balance. And that meant to us, if the industry groups are there to represent their ideas of how that new balance should look, it was clear to us that we would have to be there as well, which is why we became permanent observer in 2004. Free software and the WIPO have a lot of touching points. TRIPS has been mentioned before, is an area of interest to us, in particular since it has spawned laws like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA in the United States, the European Copyright Directive in the European Union, you know, the circumvention of technical protection measures, as it is so nicely called, is a severe problem, because you see, this allows industry to fence off what was public before. If you have a public park and you're totally entitled to be on both sides of that park, and suddenly somebody draws a fence through the middle of that park, you're still perfectly entitled to be on both sides of that park. But if you actually cross the fence, that becomes an offense. That is what this circumvention directive actually does, and it has been used quite successfully for all sorts of things, including censorship, because it puts quite a big burden on internet providers, for instance, to make sure that they don't violate these laws, that they don't violate copyright law. So all you have to do these days is to say, I don't like that website, it infringes my intellectual property, take it offline. And if they don't comply, they become personally liable. Well, that means to them, as the intermediary, that it, you know, unless they are very certain that you were, really knew what you were doing, it's much easier for them to just take it offline. You know, try to find a provider who would fight that out. So, oh, there's one. That's good. But there's not so many, unfortunately. So these are issues that have touched on free software in various ways. I mean, the DCSS case has been a very good example of this. You know, people buy DVDs in the store. They want to view them. Now they find themselves using free software and suddenly unable to view what they paid for. There is no free software player. So what do you do? Jon Johansson wrote decryption software to play those DVDs that you bought. But under DMCA and EUCD, that's illegal. Software patents are hotly debated across the globe, very hotly in the European Union, where a directive was just scrapped to introduce them. We have the broadcasting treaty that, you know, obviously, I mean, internet is broadcasting. I mean, every one of us is a broadcaster on the internet. So obviously that affects every one of us. And ultimately the development agenda, because we don't operate in empty space. We operate in a environment together with sister organizations in India and Latin America. So the development agenda, which proposes things that we actually consider very useful, in particular the WIPO Evaluation Research Office, the WERO, you know, nothing so spectacular if you think about it, that you would actually, you know, look at what you're doing and see, does this help or hurt? Do we want to do more of that or more of this? How do we want to, you know, control these instruments that we are wielding? Well, we think that's a very good idea to have. It's part of the development agenda, and it's very, very, very critical. I mean, it's not at all as easygoing as one would think. You know, people should consider it. For our direct involvement with WIPO, the WIPO policies and the technical assistance programs, we believe that all the stuff that WIPO does should be available with free software. We believe that people should not be forced through their interaction with WIPO to use non-free software. We believe people should have the freedom of choice and should have the freedom to use free software with WIPO. That, in fact, is not as critical as, you know, some people might think now. I mean, indeed, you know, with the WIPO staff, the discussions are usually quite friendly. And the WIPO ground staff is very helpful to NGOs as they are to industry organizations. So I think it's actually fair to point out that, you know, the treatment we receive actually means that we get to talk just like the industry. We have our own voice that we can raise, and we do it. We use that opportunity, but we are obviously grateful for having it. The vision that drives us to participate in that process, in that structuring, is essentially one of, you know, turning WIPO, a World Intellectual Property Organization, into a World Intellectual Wealth Organization. you know, an organization that evaluates all possibilities that exist to enrich human intellectual life, including free software, including, you know, alternative models for remuneration, you know. Of course, you know, people who write books ideally should make a living off that, if they are good books, yeah. But then, you know, who really ever does? I mean, except for, you know, the very popular novels that sell a lot. I mean, scientific books don't sell so well. I know a lot of scientists, and most of them can't live off the books they write. Most musicians I know can't make a living off the music they do. Ideally, I think they should. Yeah, it'd be good. It'd be great if they could. But I think we have to approach this from the viewpoint of what actually do we want. I mean, is more monopoly always the answer? Do we always need more monopolies? Do we need to enforce them harder? Do we need to, you know, stomp the people who trespass the monopoly more violently always? Is that always the answer to everything? We think not. I mean, monopolization is probably going to be part of a tool set of such a wealth organization, but it's not the only tool. Free software works perfectly well without over-monopolization. I believe that similar things can exist in other areas as well. We treat this right now a little bit as if it were a God-given system. It's not. It's human-made, and its purpose is to serve humankind. So we should have a dialogue on how exactly do we have to modify that system so it does that job best. And in that, I can see our, you know, friends from WIPO or the WIWO or whatever it is going to be actually playing a mediating role. It's not always as easy as that. I think there has been quite a bit of fear also on behalf of the administrative staff sometimes about, you know, who are these NGO people who now suddenly come here. But I think we're getting over that. The situation is getting more relaxed, and the fact that WIPO is present here at this meeting, I believe, is a good sign, because without a dialogue, nothing is ever going to change. And in that dialogue, I believe the Access to Knowledge Treaty can play a very important role, which is why we participate to it. And with these words, I would like to hand it over to Jamie.
Thank you very much, Mr. Grant. Mr. Love?
Thank you very much. Can you hear me in the back okay? No?
So I put my glasses, I can't tell.
I guess I'll try and speak up. So my name is Jamie Love. I work in a consumer group in Washington, D.C. called the Consumer Project and Technology. So I notice I see a lot of you I know out there. Our group's called CP Tech. And we do a lot of work on intellectual property rights. And we work with everybody in this table here. I'd like to thank Robin for inviting us. And I want to talk to you a little bit about what we think is going on right now in terms of changing the way the globalization process is taking place on intellectual property rights. Now, the first presentation by Dr. Philippe Petit from, did I get that right? From WIPO was, I think, a very good description of the way that WIPO has perceived its role for many years and thinks about things today, which is that its mission is to protect intellectual property, to promote more protection of intellectual property, to help people that are creative get more intellectual property, to sort of basically do more and more in that area, almost a missionary type role, or some people refer to it as a religious type orientation. Now, there's a different way of thinking, which is that intellectual property is more or less a tool to support innovation, and a tool to support development, and a tool to support the promotion of creative activities and things, and that you can get it right or you can get it wrong. You can go too small and not have enough protection, or you can have too much protection. Or you can think about doing it one way, but then maybe invent a better way of doing it. And so part of what's going on is that people are trying to say, in the year 2005, many years after the internet was invented, many years after the free software movement started, many years after people began to experiment with these new business models about creating knowledge books, years after things like Wikipedia got off the ground, to sort of say, hey, look at what's going on. Do you really think we need to go from 50 years to 95 years in copyright? Do you really think we need to have the complete elimination of the ability to keep a document you get from somebody and save it and open it years later because the technological protection measure may just rent it out to you for a few months and let you use it in maybe your living room but not your bedroom or something like that? I mean, are there basically, do we kind of have an idea of what the end game in terms of intellectual property is and where do we really want to go? If you think about most policy decisions we make today, they're very small decisions, kind of incremental steps. And what people, I think, should think a little bit about is if you go down a path where you take one step after the other, always in the same direction, you do it year in, you do it year out, in 20 years from now, what does the world really look like? Pardon me, there's a little too much access to knowledge here. Okay, so then one sort of scenario is that everything is owned, everything's controlled, everything's priced, everybody has to pay for everything. Documents are kind of temporarily available to you. You may or may not be able to print them. Everything is sort of under the sun is patentable, and they even sort of, you go from a first use of a medicine to a second use of a medicine to a patent on the dose to a patent on a metabolite or what happens to medicine inside your body. To business practices and maybe patenting individual genes, you know, things like that. There's sort of this sort of scenario that's possible that we could go down if we want to. We could go very far down the idea that IP everywhere, all the time, everything is owned. There is no commons. There's no public domain. Everything is a transaction. Everybody's a market. Everyone's negotiating with everybody all the time for rights. In fact, sometimes 8 or 9 people or 800 people for rights to do certain things. That you can't actually develop standards to develop new cell phone technologies or internet protocols because there's thickets of patents and lawyers are doing very well. It's a great place to send your kids to study intellectual property law. That's sort of one sort of scenario. That's sort of like what we want to avoid in our group. I mean, maybe some people think this is good, but we sort of think maybe it's better to kind of step back a second and sort of say, you know, where are we going with this? What do we really want out of the intellectual property system? And what can be done in kind of other ways of thinking about things? If all you think about is intellectual property to solve all the problems, you tend to use it maybe more than you should in some areas. And so the battle over what's going on in WIPO right now is to change WIPO. Instead of just being an organization to promote every aspect of an expansion of intellectual property rights, to think about it as an organization which optimizes where you have the intellectual property right and sets some limits and stops it from going into areas that are anti-competitive and harmful and undermine innovation and things, as many of the other panelists mentioned. I'm going to figure out how to turn this guy off. Okay. So anyway, the WIPO, I'm going to talk a little bit about the WIPO development agenda, just to give some background. Everybody talked about the WIPO development agenda. But how many people here have heard about the WIPO development agenda before today? Okay, that's probably about what you expected. All right, about 6 people. Okay, now, how many people hear about WIPO before today? Okay, like WIPO, as you heard, is the UN agency whose responsibility is to deal with it's very controversial about what its role is, but it has to do with supporting creativity. It has to do with protection of intellectual property. It has to do with development. It has to do with transfer of technology, all of those things. That's what it is. It's in Geneva. It's got a big building in Geneva, looks kind of like a UN building. And they have a very big staff. And they're mostly funded by patent money, because you can register a patent in WIPO, and over 100 countries, I think, now, is that right? Will basically accept that application. WIPO charges fees for that, and they use that money to run their organization. So they don't have to get so much money from other governments to do what they do. They have like their own income. And they really just became a UN agency in what, 1971, I think, right? Before that, they were not really part of the UN family. They signed a treaty back in 1971. Before that, they were just kind of considered a group in the North, which promoted the interest of Northern right owners. And now it's this new UN agency. So that's what WIPO is. And they've got it broken down. They've got committees on different things. That's where the work is done. They do some work in the copyright committee. They do some work in the patent committee. And they create new committees, like one on enforcement. And now they have this new meetings on development, where they try and think about the way they do work. Now, NGOs didn't pay much attention to WIPO for years. There'd be like thousands of NGOs go to WISIS meetings. And if you went back 2 years ago, there'd be maybe one NGO person, period, in the entire meeting on copyrights. I mean, maybe just one person 2 years ago or so. Isn't that right, Philippe? It was really small. I mean, talking about NGOs, I don't mean the MPAA or the, you know, the pharmaceutical industry NGO. I'm talking about, you know, what most of you people are for. So then, in the patent committee, it's still problematic. Very few people go. So they don't understand that a lot of important work is going on there, and it's important for people to participate. Now, that's changing slowly, but it'd be good if other people could make a change. So, 2 years ago, a lot of NGOs started going to WIPO and submitting papers and talking about free software and Creative Commons and access to medicine and all these different problems in the copyright committee in particular, but also some in the patent committee. Now, some of the development, the countries, some developing countries, they were really influenced by the access to medicine movement. The issue about access to drugs that are patented and doing compulsory licensing and things. There was a big thing in the WTO in 2001 on this issue, called the Doha Declaration on TRIPS and Public Health. And it was political, it was very high level. And that made the ambassadors in Geneva aware that there was something important about intellectual property. And they didn't want WIPO to undermine this 2001 victory. And so then they started working with the NGOs about a new agenda within WIPO. The expression was really what came out in 2004 when Brazil and Argentina put this proposal on the table that was fairly short at the time and only endorsed by two countries. It has now been formally endorsed by this new group, the Friends of Development. Now what's that? Well, it used to be that in WIPO they had these regional committees, and every regional committee is how all the decisions are made by the blocs. And the problem was the differences of opinion with the blocs were so serious that they couldn't really, you know, you couldn't really get much of a strong position out of most of the blocs. So led by Brazil, they now have this thing with Kenya and South Africa and lots of different countries, I can't remember them all. There's core of them, it's 14. It's organized by values and kind of viewpoint on intellectual property. They call it Group of the Friends of Development. And they take very strong positions. And they have had very serious papers, and they work with a lot of academic experts, very, very talented, and NGOs and innovative businesses to develop these new proposals. And they're very supportive of like free software and all these things that you all are interested in. So then they basically are pushing this proposal. Now the European Commission and the American government, and to some extent the Australians and certainly the Japanese, are really kind of unhappy about this, and they're trying to kind of derail this new initiative, because they think that they export intellectual property and people in developing countries are supposed to just pay as high a price as they can. They think that's just the way the trade system works. The problem is that really excessive levels of intellectual property, and not just a North-South issue, it's basically just bad public policy. It's not a good idea to tell, you know, people that try and develop software that you can't write a major software program if even one patent stands in your way. It's a problem for scientists to not get access to the work of other scientists, and not have scientists read their own research, and things like that. So what's going on is that consumer interest in the North And innovative businesses like Cisco, or some people in the computer business, are teaming up with developing country delegates in some countries to try and make like this big change in WIPO. And the development agenda goes to lots of different things, which is to say process issues, and evaluation, and trying to get more economic analysis and stuff like that in WIPO. Now, beyond that, you're hot and I'm hot. I'm just going to talk in closing about this access to knowledge treaty. Now, what is this access to knowledge treaty? Well, it wasn't really spelled out in the initial proposal last year, but it has the title. It's a treaty on access to knowledge and I think transfer of technology or something like that, or technology. But it's A2K is kind of the, you know, the term that we kind of use for it. Like, you know, it's A is in access, 2 is in, you know, like P2P or something like that, and then K for knowledge, so access to knowledge, treaty. Now, the idea in the treaty is to have something that's a positive treaty that actually benefits us, makes things better for us, not just promoting the interest of Disney or Pfizer or something like that. So, the first part of the proposal, what's that?
What parties does it benefit?
Well, the constituencies that have been talking about the Access to Knowledge Treaty are a very diverse group of people. There have been meetings about what should be basically part of a treaty, what should be the elements of a treaty. They would include things like, they would include groups like the free software movement, like librarians, like people from the consumer movement, like some of the cyber liberties groups like IP Justice or EFF has been very involved in this process, development groups like Third World Network, groups like Medicine Sans Frontiers, Doctors Without Borders, people that work on access to medicine, academic people that worked on the Human Genome Project, the people from the open access publishing movement, like that worked on the Budapest Initiative, and all these open access publishing people, they're very involved. So it's and then there's businesses that have been active, like IBM has been to some of the meetings, and Verizon, Bell South, Cisco has been sending people come out of the Internet Engineering Task Force. So there's people come out of technology community and a lot of academics as well. And the discussion is to think about if you wanted to have some benchmarks on access to knowledge, what would they be like? Now the first part of the treaty proposal that people have talked about, and it's still really at an informal level at this point, is to take what the TRIPS agreement does, the WTO, about intellectual property, which is maximum exceptions and minimum, it's minimum rights for right owners, like patent owners and copyright owners, and it's maximum exceptions. Well, the Access to Knowledge Treaty proposal turns that on its head. It proposes minimum exceptions and maximum rights. That's basically the paradigm. So the first kind of discussion that took place, probably reacting to the TRIPS agreement, was how would you sort of flip that around and think about it? And if you think of areas like distance education, where you want to have a global distance education platform, or you want to protect search engines globally, and things like that, and you want to be able to do some things everywhere, like in the area of software, it becomes quite important to think about setting some norms about basic freedoms that people have to do these kind of things. Now, the second part is this area of standards, and it's quite important in the area of software and other things, and that is the idea that the standards are a public good. Now, why do we have the internet? Well, we probably couldn't do the internet today, as Jamie Boyle recently wrote in the Financial Times. It'd probably be illegal today. You can do the internet because at the time, all the standards for the internet, all the technology was put in the public domain with no patents or royalties, and people were free to use it and implement it in different ways. Well, that was quite important, but that's about standards. And so there's all kinds of problems today in the area of standards because it's now very much easier to get patents on software processes in some countries like the United States. The standards of patentability have fallen, and there's a lot of opportunistic player. Even today, now Microsoft is now attacking the strong patent right model as it relates to software. They've asked in the United States for basically the elimination of injunctive relief as it relates to the kind of software that they develop, and effectively a compulsory license on patents in certain areas as long as the money that you pay to a patent owner, it can somehow remunerate them for some of the things. But there's there's quite technical and quite nuanced the positions people take, but standards is a real thorny problem. It's a global thing. Standards are not an American problem or a Canadian problem or a Brazil problem or a Chinese problem. And China has now raised the issue of standards in the WTO, in the Committee on Technical Barriers, saying that people are supposed to use standards to promote international trade, but there's all kinds of uncertainty about the status of standards and whether they're covered by patents, and whether or not certain countries are inappropriately putting bad patents on standards in order to engage in anti-competitive hacker and rent-seeking behavior. And a lot of people want this discussion moved in WIPO, which is essentially a curbing in the abuse of the patent system as it relates to standards. So that's one topic that's discussed among these groups who talk about these things. Another area, which has nothing to do with intellectual property rights, has to do with the free movement of researchers. Visa problems, the right of people to get to meetings to talk about things, and some of the lowering of barriers, particularly for people from developing countries, so they can actually participate more in places where you actually become part of the academic conversation. Then there's sections where people talk about things that are not really about intellectual property, but they're about collectively getting the world to do things to promote public goods. Part of it in the software area has to do with getting governments to use purchasing power, procurement, to move toward more open standards and open interfaces for certain things which are like a public good. But it also involves donors collectively agreeing to fund academic research that goes into open journals so that everyone gets access to published research that's supported by taxpayer or donor research. Or something modeled after the WTO agreement on trade and services, which involves countries making offers to liberalize certain sectors of their economy, like privatizing libraries or things like that, where collectively everybody makes all kinds of offers to permit foreigners to own part of their economy. And that's called a round of negotiations on the GATS agreement, on trade and services. So the idea of public goods is the same thing, but for public goods, and have every country say what they would do to enhance the knowledge commons, to promote access to knowledge. But it wouldn't be the same thing for every country. So some country might say, hey, we want to support the Wikipedia project by supporting some of the cost of hosting the servers. Or somebody else may say, we want to provide access to the archives of the BBC archives and put those on the web for everyone. And somebody else might say, we want to fund the human genome research or public research on SARS and make it in the public domain. The idea would be that collectively countries would make different offers and they bargain to get everybody to do more so more and more would be done. What would this involve? This would involve collective decision making to promote not private goods but public goods, and to provide an incentive, an economic incentive, and a trade mechanism to make this happen. Now, these are some of the ideas that are discussed in the idea of a treaty on access to knowledge. As you can see, it's a different kind of agenda than historically we looked at some of these institutions. Now, how's it going to happen? Well, it's only going to happen if real conversations take place with official bodies, like WIPO, or like perhaps a meeting in Athens where it's going to be held, which is apparently quite open-ended, and anything is possible. But governments have to be involved. Innovative businesses have to be involved, NGOs, academics, the kind of constituency here. It has to be a diverse and strong coalition. And we want everybody here that wants to be involved to be in touch so we can make this happen. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jamie. At this point, what I'd like to do is perhaps ask each panelist a question and invite the other panelists to also comment on the answer. So let's start with Mr. Petit. Something that you said in your presentation really struck me, and so I was hoping that you could elaborate on that. And that was that at WIPO, intellectual property rights are not always harmonizing in an upward fashion. And that really struck me as odd because I've been an intellectual property attorney for 7 years now, and that's very contrary to my experience. I've seen the scope of copyrights and patents and trademarks being increased. I've seen the duration of the term of copyright and patent being increased. we've seen the flexibilities and the limitations shrinking. And so I was wondering, what are some examples of intellectual property rights that are not being ratcheted up to a much stronger level of protection, but are actually heading in the other direction? Because I hadn't seen that anywhere.
Well, if you like me to answer now, I would say that, first, that all the interventions, I think, show that it is really useful to have this kind of exchanges, and that what I was saying, that we need to dialogue with the NGOs, and this dialogue we have here is very useful. For instance, I fully agree with Jamie Love when he says intellectual property is a tool to support creation. I fully agree with that, and anybody who would want protection for the sake of protection would be wrong. This is very clear. And so this answers also your question. It's not a target to always increase protection for the sake of protection. It's it is interesting to be developed in the way where it supports creation innovation. If it doesn't support creation and innovation, it's useless. But I often have the impression that you criticize WIPO for laws or policies which are followed or created by a small number of member states of WIPO, but not by WIPO itself, not by all member states. And if you criticize one country, you should say it and criticize the policy of one country. WIPO is only the result of all the 183 member states. I'm very conscious that this is very slow and that it cannot solve all the problems, but it is the consensus, the convergence of the positions of all these countries, and the target is to have the different national systems work together, but not to impose everybody the highest possible standards. Mr. Alex Byrne also stressed the same thing, saying that copyright laws are supposed to foster creation, but apparently at one point it happens that instead of fostering creation, they hamper creation. So this, of course, is absolutely contrary to the target, to the raison d'être, to the meaning of intellectual property protection. So I think this is very useful to stress. Mr. Grave also said very rightly that the term intellectual property is problematic because it covers too many different things. Well, as a matter of fact, I was in China last week and we were discussing the appellations of origin or geographical indications, which allow poor farmers to increase their income by 20% or 50% when they have a protected appellation for one very special kind of product, be it a kind of tea or big dates in the oasis of Xinjiang or in very poor areas. They increase their income by a kind of intellectual property protection. Of course, this has not much in common with copyright or with patents or things like that. It's true that it's a complex subject, and that unfortunately, or it's like that, WIPO has the responsibility of all these aspects, very different aspects linked with intellectual property. Well, of course, it would be good that it would become a World Intellectual Wealth Organization for the wealth to exist. It needs to be guaranteed in a way or another. So this is part of the matter to discuss. As long as you have not a legal right on your creation, on your intellectual activity, it's not a wealth. It doesn't. It's not worth anything. Same thing for the notion of monopoly. The real monopoly on innovation is when you keep it secret. when you disclose your invention, it can be used by the public. This is always the spirit of the system of patent. You can exploit, you have a right on your invention on the condition that you disclose it so that other people can work on it and go further on the basis of your own innovation. And as I said also, it's not a monopoly, since you are absolutely free to give it to somebody, to give it to the public, to sell it or whatever you like. The only protection which is sought for is that the inventor would not be deprived, would not be robbed of his invention and his right. Well, same thing about the debate about proprietary software or free software. I think it's a false case which is made against WIPO to say WIPO is not in favor of free software. This is absolutely wrong. We have no problem with free software at all. I mean, if the owner of the offer of a software is decided to give it for free or to sell with the license, well, he has a copyright, he has protection, it's a copyright, but he sells his license also with the code source. When the proprietary businessmen, they don't want to sell the sole source with their software, it's his right. We have nothing against that. So I'm always surprised when I hear that WIPO is not in favor of free software. So all this dialogue is very useful, and should help us on both sides to promote an organization for balanced, fair, and appropriate intellectual wealth system, if you like. Thank you.
I, of course, would want to comment on that. I think that we have to remember the core issues in intellectual property, and that is the question of benefiting creativity. And that's the touchstone. And I entirely agree with the comments earlier about ratcheting up periods of protection to 70 years or 95 years or whatever other absurd limitation is imagined. That in no way benefits a creator. It may well benefit a successor, a company that has bought or owns the intellectual property. Libraries are, of course, principally concerned with copyright issues, but we're also concerned with patent information and vitally concerned with issues relating to software, broadcast rights, and a range of other areas. We believe there's been an overemphasis on property and an underemphasis on other aspects of IP agenda, including the protection of moral rights and, as I said earlier, the particular interests of Indigenous peoples. To answer Robin's question, I think it's unquestioned that there's been a ratcheting up. In the harmonisation exercises that we've seen in the EU, it's been a gradual lifting of protection and a reduction in exceptions or any other measures which favour the information commons, the public domain, if you will. In my own country, Australia, our government, I'm not going to take personal responsibility, signed a free trade agreement with the United States, and particular provisions in that required the government of Australia to harmonise its intellectual property provision with the United States to increase the level beyond that which our own parliament had determined to be acceptable. Exactly the same situation, same provisions operate in Chile and in other countries. And in fact, we should remember that the United States has gone over less than 100 years from 14 years protection to 70 years protection, with little justification beyond the protection of Mickey Mouse. There is also issues relating to the interaction between different forms of IP. There isn't time here to go into that, but issues relating to, in my field of operation in academia between disclosure issues which relate to copyright in publications and the issues relating to patenting. I am, of course, because it's my personal professional area, particularly concerned about the issues relating to scholarly information. The basic situation is that we, as citizens of our countries, pay researchers to do research. Sometimes it's supported also by companies, but in all countries, a large amount of the funding comes from the public purse. For reasons of prestige, promotion, etc., our academics give away the reports on that research to publications, to publishers. Those publishers then sell it back to our libraries. This is a grim situation for those of us in rich countries like Australia and the United States. It's a devastating situation for those in poorer countries. Here in Tunisia, for example, not only do they face the problems of paying very high costs for the high quality scientific journals, but they have major problems securing foreign exchange to pay for it. So they're effectively cut off from the world of scholarly communication, with major damage to education, health, and economic development. We would do well to remember the costs of intellectual property protection, not just the lining of the pockets of individual companies, but the costs to the broader community in the reduction of economic activity. In all the rhetoric about the free market, it is certainly bizarre that we see this emphasis on the overprotection of intellectual property to the detriment of the general welfare.
Yeah. Does this need to work? Yeah, it works. Okay, let me use this one, it's better. I also think we should always emphasize or make clear that we're talking 70 years after death here. I mean, that's the kind of interesting point that I've never understood, how somebody who's dead for 70 years can be motivated to create more books by extending it another 20. That logic never really occurred to me, I have to say. It seems strange. I mean, I don't know. Maybe somebody sees a way, I don't. When the harm begins, the law should track back, was what I took from Mr. Petit's statement earlier. And indeed, that is why we have, towards WIPO suggested, in the name of the Patents, Copyrights, and Trademarks Working Group here at WISIS, that WIPO should begin evaluating the harmful effects of software patents, because that is an area where we have significant scientific studies from very renowned institutions, Deutsche Bank Research, MIT, the Institute for World Economics. I mean, these are big research institutions who show that software patents actually are detrimental to software creation, you know, software writing, software industry, software in general. So this is an area where we have identified harm. So we have suggested that WIPO should indeed start a process on limiting patentability to exclude the field of software from patentability. And I mean, I'm very happy to see that WIPO is apparently considering to do these things. There were one or two ambassadors who actually found this an interesting proposal, also in the ensuing discussion afterwards, in the plenary discussion. So, you know, I'm looking forward to starting that process, really. That's going to be quite interesting. The real monopoly is when people keep it secret. Well, then it's private, yeah. But not really, because, you see, that's the whole point. I mean, copyright legally, you know, from the way what it constructs, is a monopoly, because it says that person has the exclusive right to determine, you know, what can be done with it, whether it can be distributed, whether it can be sold or not. That person has the monopolistic control over that book, over whatever. And yes, ideally, that should be with the author. Realistically, it's with the author usually only for a very short time, because the author loses that right pretty quickly. The inventor should not be robbed. Courtney Love wrote a very interesting piece about that that I invite all of you to read. I think it was in the Salon magazine, where she said, well, the true pirates, the true robbers are the media companies, because they hold all the rights. The musicians don't really have them, and due to the gatekeeper effect of saying, well, there's like so many musicians who want to make a living off this, and you know, we control all the channels, so either you sign that contract or we're going to someone else, they've been able to enforce contracts that have been rather bad. Courtney Love's own band, Hole, had a contract with Universal, I believe. They sold several million CDs, and I believe Universal made $6 or $10 million. The band made none, nothing at all. So much for you know, artists should not get robbed. I mean, where is the robbery here? So the current system actually has significant problems, and it's relatively easy to find them. And so I believe it's important that we realize that the system we have today is not really to the interest of the authors, at least not the majority of the authors, and not really to the interest of the population. So we should reevaluate that in terms of, you know, how exactly do we need to structure that system. And yes, I mean, financial wealth certainly is one thing that could come out of doing a good job, although intellectual wealth, maybe that's because I'm not a native speaker, because in English we have, you know, in German we have the expression geistiger Reichtum, which, you know, I've been told by native speakers that actually wealth is not just financial wealth, but it also encompasses other issues. And we mix these up right now with copyright, although it's not clear how they are necessarily connected. For instance, I've spoken with many journalists for whom integrity of their work is much more important than having the monopoly on how it's used later, because they can usually cash in on this anyway, because it's the newsworthiness that is important to them. And since they don't give you the story unless you pay for it, that is never really their problem. Their main problem is with misrepresentation. So for them, for instance, it's an issue of integrity. Why is that connected to the actual remuneration issue? It's not clear to me. I'm not sure that these are necessarily connected, and I think that, you know, if we open the perspective a little bit, we can actually find more examples like this where we see, I mean, this may have been how it has been always for us, since, you know, none of us is older than the invention of the copyright system, I assume. But, you know, it's not God-given. I mean, it's a tool. Everybody here seems to agree that it's a tool. But, you know, if all you got a hammer, you know, everything will look to you like a nail. Let's open our mind away from the hammer and actually see what other tools exist out there. I mean, yes, a hammer can be a very useful tool. I don't disagree with that, actually. I don't think that we should necessarily use it for anything, though. I think there are certain functions, certain tasks that need doing, for which a hammer is not the best tool. And so I think it's the same with granting monopolies on, you know, creative works, for instance.
Short on time.
Well, if I could say a couple positive things about WIPO. First, I'd like One very positive, I think, is the fact that one of the most important officials in WIPO is on this panel today, knowing, you know, everyone's going to be pounding away, you know, criticizing strong IP regimes. And I think that WIPO has been very open about engaging in people in civil society and consumer movement and free software and librarians on these issues. And I think that's a very important thing, and I think we all appreciate it very much. Also, if you look at the agenda for on next Monday starts the 13th session of the Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights. And the first item after adoption of the agenda is exceptions and limitations to copyright. This is an agenda item that was put on the agenda by Chile. It's a very important agenda item. And WIPO has commissioned some excellent work and done great, I think, work with Chile on this issue and helped sponsor meetings in Chile about it, but also a great report by Mr. Rickinson from Australia, which was quite useful, I think, in this regard. So I think that this is an area where WIPO's work has been welcome. And Chile is talking about having a treaty on minimum exceptions and limitations in the area of copyright. They focused on the area of schools, libraries, and the handicapped. Now, other people may want to raise other internet-related issues into this discussion, but this actually is something where the expertise of civil society and academic experts and people in private industry is actually a very important thing to have in these meetings. The other thing is that I want to say, though, that's a bit critical of WIPO is that, and this is not about Dr. T, but this is more about the copyright initiative on the in the broadcast treaty and in the patent treaty. In both cases, the WIPO secretariat went outside of diplomatic channels to try and find people in developing countries who would override or undermine the positions of Geneva delegates were taking. Because I think that there are some people in the WIPO secretariat that perceive the Geneva diplomats who come out of the foreign service for the countries as to be some enemy that they have. And so they're in a strategy in these two treaties, which has backfired in both cases, particularly the so-called Casablanca meeting in terms of the patent treaty meeting, to convene meetings that were designed to sort of show some consensus for some maximalist position on very controversial treaties. And I think that's not constructive and helpful. I think that it's better to think about finding ways that senior officials at WIPO can actually give expressions to more balanced views about these issues. Now, in contrast, for example, in the bird flu controversy going on right now, the WTO Secretariat issued an excellent, and I mean an excellent, frequently asked questions guide to how to do compulsory licensing, which was designed to specifically assist countries which are considering issuing compulsory licenses on patents on Tamiflu. And it was widely used and actually acted on, most recently by Taiwan. Now, that's an area where the WTO Secretariat, this is not the way it would have done 5 years ago, but it's the way it does it right now, understands that it is not just there to represent patent owners in these disputes. It's there to represent everybody, including people who might need access to medicine. So what we'd like to hear from WIPO in more of these meetings at a high level, not only is extolling the virtues of the intellectual property system, which are completely true in the areas, in certain areas, but to also find ways to discuss the control of anti-competitive practices, curbing of abuses, or setting some limits on areas where the intellectual property system creates more harm than it's worth. And when we start to hear those conversations, we will know that we have a UN agency rather than a trade association looking at these problems of intellectual property.
We're almost out of time, and I really wanted to make sure we get some questions from the audience. So was there anyone who had any questions? Yes, in the back, would you mind introducing yourself? Oh, maybe you could come up here and use the microphone, because it's really hard to hear.
First of all, I wanted to apologize because my mother tongue is not English. I come from Argentina and I speak Spanish. I think that, I am also a lawyer, so I want to apologize for that too. But the thing is that I think that this panel is not balanced, because the voice of intellectual property producers is not represented here, and I think that is important. And it is also not represented underdeveloped countries, because I work for software companies in my country, which is underdeveloped, and my customers, the developers, the intellectual property developers in my country does not like GPL licenses or free software licenses, because, very short, because they feel that they are paying licenses to developed countries and they will not receive the same pay for their productions. So producing free software is subsidizing developed countries.
Thank you very much.
Let me just briefly. You may or may not know this, but the Free Software Foundation actually is a fiduciary of hundreds of software authors, and protects their interests under the GNU General Public License, which they have chosen to license according to the copyright system. So, you know, these are the primary authors of the GNU system, which is the basis of GNU Linux, you know, which runs quite a bit of, you know, the internet on many servers by now and is used in many places around the world. So, you know, although I can't speak naturally for all of them, you know, at least a part of their interests has been very clearly expressed and along the lines of what I described. Whether, you know, releasing software under the GPL is subsidizing the North is an interesting notion. I heard this raised, I think, by some Microsoft executive some time ago. Most of the free software developers that I know actually are not from the South. We've seen a lot of software development happening, and there is by now, there are people from the South developing free software also, yes. But they benefit from the work of others around the world. I mean, and a lot of those developers sit in the United States, a lot of them sit in Europe, and these are not exactly southern countries. So this is a global community that actually works together for the benefit of everybody. And, you know, the Argentinian developer, in fact, I will be going to Argentina on Saturday for the first meeting of the Free Software Foundation Latin America, and to speak in a conference on free software. The Argentinian developer is in fact quite welcome to use what everyone else on this planet in the 190 other countries has been writing. And usually, working together has proven to be a much more effective model than not working together. Cooperation is a very, very strong approach, and I believe the free software movement has shown this.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I'm not able to take any more questions. We're technically a little bit over time, but I wanted to thank all of our panelists for participating and sharing their expertise with us, and thank all of you for attending. Thank you so much.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had to do an interview with...
That's okay.